We have first on our agenda a work session on Senate Bill 203, and I understand that members of the committee have been talked to. We had tried to get a compromise amendment drafted, and that was not satisfactory. And so I wanted to open this up for a work session and invite Kelly Skye and up to the table if she would like to comment on that before we vote on this.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members
Welcome
of the committee.
Kelly Skye,
legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And my colleague, Mr. Hummel, had testified against this bill. OCDLA still objects to the bill in that it is further limiting or removing the incentive for mandatory reporters to report these crimes to law enforcement by not requiring that reporting to a mandatory reporter tolls the statute of limitations. So we have that problem, and as a policy issue, we would object to the extension of statute of limitations, which effectively this will do in a narrow number of cases. Mr. Hummel and Mr. Neely worked on coming to an agreement on the amendment. I believe that Mr. Neely has a proposed amendment. I'm not sure if it's here. Our opinion was that amendment, in practical effect, did the same thing that the original bill did. So they were not able to come to an agreement.
I appreciate that, and thank you for giving us that background. And maybe I could just have our counsel, I probably should have done this first, but our counsel sum up very quickly for the committee what the issue in Senate Bill 203 is, which is already, we've already had a public hearing on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is a bill that would amend the statute of limitations in a list of enumerated sex and child abuse cases. The current statute is a three-part alternative in which time the prosecution must be commenced, and the third alternative states that the prosecution must be commenced within 6 years after the report is made to law enforcement or other government agency. And this bill would amend the other government agency language and delete that, and in its place put the Department of Human Services. And the suggestion arose out of a Court of Appeals case in which a report of sex abuse was made to a public school teacher who was a mandatory reporter. It was never passed on to law enforcement or the Department of Human Services. And when the case was prosecuted, that issue was litigated, and it was determined that the public school teacher was another government agency within the meaning of the statute of limitations, and it was determined that the statute had run for that reason. So this bill would change that problem if that were to occur, perceived problem if that were to occur in the future. The statute would not begin to run until the report was actually made either to law enforcement or the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
I'm needing some help with this bill. I'm having some confusion. This is really relevant to some recent circumstances we've had here in Marion County and to some legislation I'm currently drafting and have drafted and plan on introducing. I don't understand Ms. Skye's testimony that this would limit or remove the incentive for mandatory reporters to report these crimes. I don't understand that. And I'm going to need Ms. Skye to come up and explain that, or someone else here to explain that. I don't understand why it would remove that incentive.
Let me take a shot at it, and if that's not satisfactory, you can ask.
And I apologize that I missed the first hearing.
The way I look at this bill is this bill actually deals with those circumstances where a mandatory reporter does not do their duty under the statute. They're legally required to make the report immediately to law enforcement or the Department of Human Services. In cases where they don't fulfill that duty, this would prevent the statute of limitations from starting. The statute of limitations would not start until the proper agencies, DHS or law enforcement, were informed. So, if you still have further questions, but that's the crux of what this does. And the reason I support this bill is because I don't think victims should have to pay the price if someone doesn't do their duty under the statute.
Well, Madam Chair, I would agree 100% with you, because I have concerns about that anyway. There is a statute on when the case can be prosecuted, and I think it actually should be lifted. I don't think there should be any time period, because you have students. You may have a 13-year-old child who, by the time they're 19, they finally figure out that this happened to them because they shut it off in their mind, and they bring it forward, and you bring it forward, it may be past the 6 years. So I don't understand what the problem is here, and I see Senator Prozanski wants to respond to what I'm talking about. But
Before we have Senator Prozanski, I want to give deference to you, Senator, but counsel had a comment.
No, that's fine. I do want to respond as to what the statute currently provides for. I mean, it's pretty clear as to what is provided for, but it's also, I think, a bigger question as to, we'll get there.
Because you had a
Madam Chair, and in response to Senator Walker's comments, this may give you more information. In my initial comments, I only gave you the third alternative for the statute in these enumerated cases. Let me give you all three. These are the three alternative time limits on the prosecution for the enumerated felonies and some enumerated misdemeanors. So the prosecution must be commenced within one of the earliest of these three times. First, within 6 years after the commission of the offense itself. Second, any time before the victim reaches the age of 24, if the victim was under 18 at the time of the offense. Or third, within 6 years after the offense is reported to a law enforcement agency or other governmental agency. It must be within whichever occurs first. And this bill only speaks to that third alternative.
And it only changes the Department of Human Services.
It changes other governmental agency to the Department of Human Services.
My questions have been answered. I'm good to go. Let's pass this thing. But
Senator,
there's other questions.
Did you wish to say?
I did. I mean, I think there's a couple points. I want to respond with Senator Walker. I mean, there's another component to that, depending on what the crime is. There is a little different time frame, but the reality is, if the child is a minor, there is that extended period of time until after they reach their majority before the statute would run. And so in both cases of the more serious crimes, which has the 6 years, you also have another one that's 22 years of age and 4 years for less offenses. But I think there's another part that here is, we apparently, from what I understand, there was a teacher who actually did report to her superiors or his superiors, and then there was the ball that was dropped there. It seems to me, what's the ramifications for those agencies, for those people within the agencies, not following through and doing what they needed to do? And as we take care of making certain that the victim may still retain the ability to bring charges that would result in a criminal prosecution, it also seems to me that if you got a reporter failing to do their job, what's the ramifications there? And I don't know if we have that today.
Senator Walker.
Yes, Madam Chair. I believe I have Senate Bill 872 in this committee, which increases the prison sentence, hopefully a prison sentence, and the fine associated with a mandatory reporter's failure to report. Also, I'm working on an amendment to that to extend the statute of limitations on that failure to report. And hopefully we're going to hear this bill in committee, and we're going to hear from district attorneys as to why they're not prosecuting those failure to report cases. Because they aren't doing it now. I mean, if they're doing it, I don't know about it. Marion County's not doing it. Wayne County, I don't know who in the state is doing it, but it's not happening.
It is listed in the statute, as you know. What I can't remember off the top of my head is whether it's a violation or a misdemeanor.
Right.
I elevate it to a Class A misdemeanor in my bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Further discussion? Actually, we need a motion before we're supposed to be doing...
Madam Chair?
Yes.
You asked for discussion, so throw something in the mix here. I'm going to vote for this bill, but I want to be very cognizant of the rights of the accused. And when you extend statutes of limitations, as John Hummel testified, it makes it more difficult to defend. And while it's easy for us to focus solely on the victim and express sympathies with the victim, as certainly we should, we also have to balance that with the rights of people to have a good defense. And I just want to, I'm voting yes, but I'm sympathetic to the arguments made by the criminal defense lawyers, and I want to just put that on the record.
Thank you, Senator Pazenza.
And I guess I'd follow suit on that, too. I mean, I looked at this, and I looked at what it says for other governmental agencies, and I think it's appropriate that what we're doing is going to clarify it and really get it to the two agencies who are, let's say, most in charge or best in position mm-hmm. to actually deal with these type of allegations as compared to someone who may work in similar area of state government, such as the Department of Transportation, whoever, that would be considered a governmental agency. And so I think that's appropriate. But I also think the statute of limitations, I know we've looked at this throughout my time on judiciary, making sure there is that balance for both victims to be able to have redress and at the same time making certain that there's a balance of not allowing stuff to go to the point of where someone is not able to even defend some allegation because no one is guilty until it's proven in court. And as a prosecutor, I think that's one of those balances that we need to maintain, and we'll see what comes through during the rest of the session.
That's correct. And we will have this issue of the statute of limitations before us and other bills. And so I appreciate your comments. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be willing to make a motion, and before I make any comments, if you wish a motion.
I would be thrilled.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 203, excuse me, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 203 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion, Senator Beyer?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I think this is an important fix or potential fix. I thought we would see an amendment to maybe narrow it a little more than this. I'm perfectly happy with this personally, but the comments were that. But I think it's important that I brought the issue up, and I'd like to ask counsel if he had researched it. In an instance, as I brought up in the last hearing, and it's not a fictitious instance, but if a mandatory reporter is also the perpetrator of the crime, if we don't change this law and the mandatory reporter doesn't report it, obviously, if he's the person who's doing the crime, did that start the statute of limitations if we don't change this law somehow?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer. I did not research to search for a case in which that had occurred, but I did have a conversation with, I believe, I want to say it was Kevin Neely at the Department of Justice, but I apologize if it wasn't him. And he had indicated to me that that may very well be the case with the way the statute is written right now, that could begin the statute from running. But I had also been informed that there was a belief that there was a bill to address that issue to make clear that in other words, there would be an exception if the mandatory reporter was the person who perpetrated the abuse.
Okay, would that be Senate Bill 200? Because I know Senate Bill 200 is on the agenda today. Is very, I mean, it's the same chapter of law, and that's not it.
I'm sorry, okay. Senator Beyer. No, that is not it.
So
it's a different issue.
Okay, so
it is the same statute, but it's a different.
The other issue here then would be let's say if an employee of the Department of Human Services, even with this bill passing, was to, you know, abuse a child. Does that then, from my understanding, is that sounds like that would trigger the statute unless we do something else. It would trigger the top of the clock ticking on that 60-year time limit.
That's a very good question, Senator Beyer.
Senator Beyer, in my opinion, yes. I think there would be a very good argument that would start the statute.
If we pass this bill, if this bill gets through the process, and an employee of the Department of Human Services abuses a child, and obviously that is a mandatory reporter under this bill, that starts the clock ticking of that 6-year clock. If it's not found out by anyone else and that person doesn't report the crime, obviously he is the one perpetrating the crime, he probably, or she, is not going to be reporting the crime to law enforcement. there's still a loophole in potentially in the statute.
And Senator Byer, I think not only that, but I think the same argument could be made if the perpetrator was a member of a law enforcement
certainly,
agency.
Yes. Yeah.
If the perpetrator was what?
A member of a law enforcement agency.
Oh.
These are...
I think that's one of those things that we'd hope would never happen. If it did, I mean, the question is, how would the courts look at that? And the question really comes down to whether that person actually had a duty to report at that point, because then you're talking about incrimination of themselves, and so there may even be a perspective that they wouldn't have a duty to report, because that could be self-incrimination. So
if I could, Senator Przanski, I think that's a good point, but I think what that would go to is whether or not that individual could then be prosecuted perhaps for failure to report as required.
Right.
They may very well have a defense saying that I have a Fifth Amendment right not to report it because it would have incriminated myself, and that would be their defense. I don't think it would go to whether or not the statute would start running.
Right.
Is there further discussion? Senator Whitson?
You know, I share in the concern, Madam Chair, about the extension of the statute of limitations. I think that we could set up a situation where we could have another Amaralting in Massachusetts where...
Excuse me, could you speak up a little bit?
We could run into a situation like the Amaralts had in Massachusetts where it was very difficult to defend themselves. And that I have a concern about. More fundamentally, I have the concern that it seems to me that we're dealing with a symptom rather than a cause here. To me, the cause is someone has failed to report as the law says they must. And perhaps we should be more focused on dealing with the enforcing the law that we have rather than writing another one.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt, any other discussion here? Okay. Senator Byer has moved... Senate Bill 203 to the Senate floor. I think we'll do a roll call on this, which we don't normally do. Go ahead.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator Przanski?
Aye. Oh.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsett?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator or Chair Burke?
Aye. Senate Bill 203 has passed and will move to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. And Senator Przanski has asked to carry it. Now we will close the work session on Senate Bill 203 and move into a public hearing on... I'll just do them in order. On Senate Bill 198. Go ahead. Counsel, would you summarize Senate Bill 198?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 198. I'm actually looking for my summary, pardon me. This is the bill that would allow an alleged victim of a person crime to select a personal representative to accompany them to virtually all phases of the investigation and prosecution except for grand jury proceedings and specified child abuse assessments. It would prohibit the court and law enforcement from preventing that personal representative from accompanying the alleged victim to those phases of the investigation.
Thank you. Why don't we call Phyllis Barkhurst and Ronell Schenkel, who wanted to testify together.
Why don't we just follow up to...
Chair Burdick, with your permission, may we also bring District Attorney Paul Burdett up to the table with us?
Please do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Ronell Schenkel. I'm the Policy Project and Legislative Coordinator for Attorney General Hardy Myers. And please let me begin by offering apologies on behalf of the Attorney General. He wanted to be here today to speak to you about his sexual assault task force. and is otherwise occupied right as we speak in Ways and Means giving our budget kickoff presentation. So, I don't know, matter of priorities, I guess, but I'm happy to be here.
No,
like perhaps he's been summoned, but he really wanted to be here and wanted to make certain that I offered his apologies. So I've provided you with some brief testimony that Hardy asked that I share with you. I'm not going to walk you through that because of certainly you can read it, and some of you may already be familiar with the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. But I did want to provide you with that written background, if this is a new group to you, and tell you that it really fits into Hardy's and the department's overall services, because we do have several diverse portions within our department where we serve crime victims and other citizens of Oregon. And then it also is an important part of the Attorney General's overall law improvement strategy in looking at various areas of the law such as this and bringing before you some ideas to perhaps improve those laws. We have three bills in front of you today. Phyllis Barkhurst, who is the director, is our technical expert and can speak to these in much more detail, and Paul Burgett has been serving as the district attorney liaison representative on the task force and also is much more of an expert than I in this arena. I will offer to you, though, on behalf of the Attorney General, that on these bills, this one in particular up before you now, Senate Bill 198, when the bill was introduced, some issues came to our attention that we had not resolved, and so we do have some potential amendments. We have, I believe staff has provided with you with a copy of some draft language, and we would respectfully ask you not move to work session today if you are in agreement with us working to further refine this bill. So with that, I'll turn it over to Phyllis.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Phyllis Barkhurst, and I'm the director of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, and that's 93 Van Buren Street in Eugene, 97402. I just reached my 25th year in the field of addressing domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and just reached my 20th year doing this in Oregon. I spent 7.5 years in Klamath Falls as the director of the Sexual Assault, Domestic Violence, Child Abuse Organization there, and 8 years in Lane County in Eugene as the director of the Sexual Assault Support Services there. I spent the last 4 years working on statewide issues with the task force. The role of the task force is to look at the big picture and identify gaps and problems, and the role of the task force is to promote best practices. So one of the ways we do that is to take input from the field and from the expertise that's reflected on the more than 100 people that work on the task force and its committees. The role of the task force is also to promote a victim-centered response, knowing that this increases the chances of good prosecution and good investigation. To that end, we support the development of sexual assault response teams and all multidisciplinary efforts across the state. And this particular bill, Senate Bill 198, came from conversations and recommendations from our Victim Response Committee, which is made up of 16 victim advocates from both law enforcement, prosecution, and nonprofit-based programs from around the state. And the best practice that we're promoting is the idea that a victim of a person crime, especially an intimate person crime such as sexual assault or domestic violence or child abuse, is in a fragile emotional state in the aftermath of such a crime. And that the research shows very well what advocates already know is that having a support person can very much mitigate the trauma involved. I'd like to point out to the committee that for victims, there interaction with the criminal justice system is brief. They're dealing with the victimization of what happened to them as a lifelong event, and anything that can be done in the aftermath, and especially in the immediate aftermath, to mitigate the trauma, we believe should be done, and that it can be done in a way that also supports investigation and prosecution. And that's where this bill has come from. One of the reasons we chose to develop a personal representative bill was to make sure that some of the what we call the potluck syndrome that happens around the state is addressed, meaning that any time a victim goes into and has contact with individual agency, she or he may have a very different experience from somebody who goes to that very same agency 4 hours later, 6 hours later, or across the county line. So in promoting the best practices, I wanted to reflect what, if I may, what President Lincoln said about addressing slavery plantation by plantation. It doesn't work. So we come to this looking at it from a statewide perspective, how we can promote a victim-centered response that is consistent, is in line with the research that shows mitigation of trauma and also support investigation and prosecution. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your work on the Sexual Assault Task Force. We've seen some really fine proposals come forward from that group. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Burdick.
Chairman Burdick and ladies and gentlemen, from the prosecutor's point of view, we think that this law needs
to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry, Paul Burgett. I'm Coos County DA, and I'm on the Sexual Assault Task Force. We think that this law might take a little work in terms of language and so forth, but the idea is simply to have a friendly person there with you during law enforcement contact. Because the crime itself oftentimes is really disturbing and upsetting for people, and then they're in a kind of a foreign environment with the police, and it can be daunting and scary for people. And the experience in other states, from what I understand, has been that this is actually a very good thing. It just helps a victim settle down and work effectively with the police in terms of communicating what happened and minimizes the trauma. And that's really the only purpose of the so-called representative is not meant to really be a participant, to interfere in any way with law enforcement or create any difficulty in the process. It's only a kind of a hand holder. And that just doesn't happen. I mean, victims assistance programs are designed to perform that function a little bit, but actually having a friend with you as opposed to a stranger. You know, if you've been raped, you're going to have a rape victim advocate show up, and they're a stranger. And you'll be dealing with strange medical people you've never met. And humiliating sort of things happen to you. And then you deal with a policeman, some of whom are very sensitive and compassionate and wonderful, and some aren't. And the idea here is to simply put in to the process the ability to have a friend with you to make it a more humane process. That's where we're trying to get. We may need to work on the language a little bit, but that's our objective.
Thank you very much. Do you have any idea, any of you, how often an alleged victim is denied an opportunity to bring someone with them into these circumstances?
Senator Burr, members of the committee, all we have is anecdotal information. And the anecdotal information is that it happens, different agencies reflect that it happens several times a year. There's no data, but enough people have concerns that they brought it to the attention of the task force to look at a statewide answer.
Okay, great. Thank you for that response. Other questions? Senator Byers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was my first question, I guess. Is there anything preventing this from happening now in the statute? This is an additional statute. There's not something that prevents it in the statutes?
I think that a victim could insist on having a friend present now, and they would have the ability to do that. We understand that some agencies, though, then will say, okay, interview's over. And the police don't have to necessarily pursue an investigation, and they can try to call the shots. They're in a dominant position. And that would, of course, be somewhat of a traumatic negative event for the victim. So the idea is to just make it so that it's a natural thing. I think most people would not necessarily even want a so-called representative or friend with them. But those that do, it's an important thing.
Follow up.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there, I don't think it is, but is there this any way create a mandate so that the court would then have to appoint a friend to be with somebody and an injured friend? I mean,
well, that's a whole new process. You probably could create something like that, but then the courts would have to, people might want to be compensated, which I don't think the state wants to deal with right now. And it's really not necessary to have a court. This could just be a private thing where the victim says, I would like my mom with me, for example. I'd like my next-door neighbor with me. We're friends. Just to be a helping hand. And it can be quite informal. It just gives her the right to do that. And it would probably fix it so that the police, if there's a statute like this in place, they'd be hard-pressed to say, interview's over. We're not in the case, which they can do now. It's not the right thing to do, but it could happen.
Senator Burdick, may I respond to that?
Yes,
as well, Senator Byer, many of these cases never get to court or anywhere near the that part of the system. This bill is trying to also address the immediate medical response or the interviews that of cases of which you know, a high percentage never gets far enough so that the court gets involved in the case at all.
And the, Senator Byers' question raised a question in my mind, too, which is this applies to people over 15 years of age, and I presume that younger people already have, like, their mom with them or a family member in these circumstances.
Senator Burdick, this was in response to a series of meetings over several years with the child abuse response community to define and try to come up with some common practice of age of consent, at which time, at what time can a child really have true consent to be able to know what they're saying and who they're choosing, and also to address the concerns of the child abuse community that often for children, the person that they may choose may be somebody who turns out to be involved in the crime itself. So this, the age of 15, we came at this because that's an age when someone can consent to medical a medical procedure or practice without parental consent. And law enforcement agencies around the state have a range about at what age they will interview a child without parental permission and knowledge, but 15 is in that range. But it comes from an agreement, and we spent over a year on this one issue with the larger child abuse community in Oregon trying to distinguish a child abuse response to an adolescent or an adult response. So that's where the age came from.
Chair Burdick, if I might add and direct you to the proposed amendment handout that came before you, you also see that highlights one of the issues that Phyllis has been working with Department of Human Services on and the Child Protective Services is how they will continue to provide those services to children who are potentially in an abusive situation. And so that's one of the amendments that we are looking to remedy to make sure that we do not impact that existing process. I also want to tie into something that Paul said, which is the Oregon District Attorney's Association did raise an issue when this first came out with Attorney General Hardy Myers, and again, Phyllis is working with them. I don't know that we have their language yet, but working with them to make sure the language does not have some other legal connotation. It truly is intended, as Paul said, to be a friend, someone to give you moral support, not some sort of new legal descriptor.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee?
One question.
Senator Krasanski.
This is something that I guess is already called for in the bill, or maybe under the law. I'm just looking at to see what's new, what's not. There's a definition, or within the definition of law enforcement agency, it says a special campus security officer and a commission under, and that's basically deals with higher ed security personnel. And I guess the question is, when you look at how it says protective service workers, or those employees or contractors at all, whose role is to protect children and vulnerable adults, how they're picked up in this definition, considering, I would assume that the special campus security officers are there more for adults, not per se children, and are we now seeing that kids that are young people who are going to universities that are vulnerable adults?
Chair Burnett, Senator Poznanski, I think we weren't connecting those at all. The issue of the law enforcement on campuses was to get to those two universities that have sworn officers and do their own investigations to make sure they were included in this list of law enforcement, and definitely intended that to be adult response.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you very much. We will move to our next witness, who is Una Swanson. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Una Swanson. I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. And I'm here today to let the committee know that we are opposed to Senate Bill 198 in language only.
so we're opposed to it as written, but we support the concept, and we have been working collaboratively with the task force on, and we support and conceptually the amendments that have been recommended.
Would you mind elaborate what those issues of concern, so we just kind of understand what you might be looking for in a way of a resolution?
Certainly, and I just realized that I forgot to hand off my test. Chair Burdick, Senator Przanski, the testimony that's written will give more specific information about the concerns, but very briefly, there is language that is not clear in the current written amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there, it sounds from your testimony that you're on the road to working out the issues that you've identified.
Chair Burdick, yes, we are. We've been working together with him.
Thank you. Well, we'll look forward to seeing what you come up with. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Terry Quinteros. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Close enough.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Terry Quinteros, and I am the Program Director for Crime Survivors for Community Safety, which is a program of the Western Prison Project. I have also been working in domestic and sexual violence shelters in the state of Oregon since 1989. And we strongly support Senate Bill 198. We have already heard this afternoon that when someone experiences trauma, it's a very vulnerable time in their life, and it's also really difficult for folks to comprehend everything that has happened to them and also be able to take in all of the information that's being presented to them. And we believe that this bill will help empower victims and survivors to access the system as it stands to the fullest of its extent.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 198 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 199 with the same cast of characters that we had before, Phyllis Barkhurst, Manuel Schenkel, and Paul Brigette, if you would come up. And we also have... How many chairs do we have?
Again, for the record, Ron Elfschenkel, I'm the Policy Project and Legislative Coordinator.
I just got so excited about hearing your testimony, I forgot the summary here. So Mr. O'Leary will summarize this bill. Thank you.
I defer to Jeff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 199 amends the statute that allows the court to enter protective orders as to the disclosure of evidence, and it would require upon request of a district attorney that the court order or prohibit, the copying or disseminating of sexually explicit evidence in cases that involve a sexual offense or a specific offense of involving a child engaged in sexual conduct.
Thank you. Now, please proceed.
Okay, for the record, Ron Elschenkel, Policy Project Legislative Coordinator for the Attorney General. Again, my apologies that Attorney General Hardy Myers could not be here today to speak to you about a sexual assault task force. I did not prepare a second set of written testimony. I put all three bill numbers on the first one by way of background for your record. I will simply point out on this particular bill, as I mentioned in previous testimony today, one of the key elements of the sexual assault task force is the law improvement portion of the work that this very diverse committee does. Phyllis and Paul will be able to speak to you more on this topic, but this particular bill related to protective orders is not only important to the victims involved in these crimes, but ties directly into public records requests, which is a key issue for the Department of Justice. And so we're here in support of this bill.
Thank you very much.
Again, for the record, Phyllis Barkhurst, I'm the Executive Director of the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. I just wanted to let you know briefly where this bill came from. There's been, people have been bringing cases or complaints about victims and their privacy, believing that they've been violated and or harmed, and brought issues in specific examples to us as a task force, which we refer to our Criminal Justice Committee, and of which the District Attorney, Paul Gorgett, was the chair of that committee, and that's where the origin of this bill came from. Thank you.
Chair Burdick, Paul Burgett, Coos County DA and member of the Sexual Assault Task Force. What this law is designed to deal with is to create a limited right of privacy for victims of sexual assault and other related crimes. The way the system works, when a rape or some sort of sexual assault occurs, an investigation occurs, usually there's a defense attorney that comes in on the other side, and they will investigate the victim, and part of the way these cases work is that they will be very interested in the prior sexual history of the victim. We have a rape shield law in Oregon that says generally a lot of that information is not going to go before a jury because it's regarded as irrelevant. On the other hand, I had a just as an example, I had a case in Coos County where we kept all the victim's prior sexual history out via the rape shield law, and then a few days later we read about it in one of our newspapers. And there's provision for the court to seal the record, but the defendant himself knows the information, and his attorney knows it, and there's absolutely nothing stopping them from sharing that information with the media. And that can pretty much destroy a victim. And it does it goes a long way. When you destroy the victim, you're really destroying a case that should really be determined on the merits. And I think hopefully we can all agree that a person's prior sexual history generally has nothing to do with whether they were raped on a given occasion. And that's what the rape shield law is about. What this does is it simply requires the court to disallow anybody involved in the proceedings, any attorney or agent for any attorney, from copying or disseminating that information. Imagine, for example, in a child abuse case, there's a tape where a little child is telling an investigator about all these terrible things that happened to her. As it is right now, that can be copied. I had a case where we have information that a defense attorney showed this to a bunch of people in his house on a weekend. Now, if you were a parent of that child, how would you feel that people know about, you know, terrible intimate details that happened to your child that they have really no business? No, this is government business. We need to prosecute the case. The person's guilty or not guilty, you deal with it and get on. The general public doesn't really have a right or any business to know about a lot of these things, in my opinion. And certainly a victim's prior sexual history is none of the public's business, especially if the court says it's not coming in under the rape shield law. If it does come in, it's going to end up being the public's business. It's a public record. People can go to the trial. The press can print it. So be it. But probably 90% of cases are dealt with via some sort of plea. And, of course, there are a lot of cases that never make it so far as even going to court. But our position is that this information should not be in the public domain. It's really private information. We have in our files sometimes pictures. We'll have CDs with thousands of pictures off the Internet. Who knows what? We've had videotapes of children having sexual relations. That stuff is part of our file. That should not ever become any part of the public record. If you look at the effect it's going to have on those kids. So the idea here is to create a limited right of privacy and give some dignity and respect to victims and let the government use the information as they have to, but not just because there's a criminal case put this stuff out into the public domain. We just think that that's the main reason victims don't want to report rapes. And in fact, we had a police officer in one of our cases after she saw what happened to our victim saying, hey, if I was raped, I'd never report it. Because you end up getting beat up, even if you're successful and win the case, your life is pretty well ruined. So why would somebody want to put themselves through that? So the approach here is to create a limited right of privacy where the people that need to know, the government can do its job, know and they deal with it, but we don't make it a big public spectacle. So that's pretty much all I have.
Chair Burdick, if I may then just conclude briefly, you have some proposed amendments again on this bill. We also respectfully ask that you not move it to work session. As Paul and Phyllis just described, while conceptually this may be a fairly easy concept for us all to grasp and agree to, as you can see by our amendments, we struggled with the actual language to make sure we pick up all the instances and types of things that might be involved in audio and video recordings. You'll see some of that language here. We decided as a safeguard, so there's no loophole, that we should probably have a cross-reference in the actual public records law to make sure people are aware of this other law. And then the last piece just came to our attention before the hearing that there may be some concern by the Oregon criminal defense lawyers on the use of the term expert witness, and we'll look at that as well.
Thank you. Now, it's my understanding that judges have the discretion to do this now, but this would make it mandatory?
I believe that judges clearly have the ability to enter protective orders. And there's some case law on that, that there are some limits on the court's discretion, from what I understand. And what this would do, it's like Phyllis mentioned in the last hearing in terms of dealing with slavery from plantation to plantation. I think if you have an enlightened judge, it can work pretty well the way we have it. It would still require some change to the public records law. And also, in terms of records being sealed and unsealed, that's in the discretion of the court now. A court could figure, well, when the criminal matter is done, I'm going to unseal the records. Well, that could have a very destructive impact on the victim. So we're thinking that this really needs a legislative guidance so that uniformly statewide we'd have a policy that's sensitive to victims' rights.
Right. Now, there are two sections, two kinds of exemptions under the public records law. There's an absolute exemption where it just can't be released, and then there's a conditional exemption where there's an appeal process through the Attorney General to get the records released if you can show a public interest. I presume that this would put the exemption under the absolute exemption to the public records law?
That's my understanding.
Chair Burdick, we do have an attorney here from the Department of Justice. If you'd like him to come forward and answer that question, he helped us with some of the initial drafting.
Okay, thank you. I don't think that's necessary unless you want to, because we're going to be considering this further. Mm-hmm. Have you come across a lot of cases where you felt that a judge should have issued one of these protective orders and haven't?
We've had kind of a bad experience in Coos County. Our courts have pretty much uniformly said in the case, and this has only come up in the case of tapes out of child advocacy centers, and we have tried to get the courts to order that those should be protected, and our courts have uniformly refused to do that. And the problem we have at that point is that's pretty much in the judge's discretion. And what that does is sends a message to victims. And as a parent, if something happened to my kids, I'd be reticent to have them participate in a process where something could get into the press that would be humiliating to them for life. And I think that tends to discourage reporting. It's a bad public policy, and I think we need your help to fix that. And I'm not complaining about our courts. I have great respect for them. They're doing their job. But I think that this is an awfully big issue, and it really means a lot to victims to have not complete privacy, but just some protection.
And Chair Burdick, also in response, one of the roles of advocates is to let victims know what to expect. In this situation, we can't, because what we can say is it depends on the judge you get, which we think there should be a better answer than it depends on the judge you get, and that's one reason we came forward.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Walker, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm not sure what I think about this. Certainly from a survivor point of view and a victim point of view, I understand this. But I'm trying to draft some legislation right now, because what I find is that school teacher records are kept confidential, and school teachers or administrators or school personnel who sexually abuse children, and we're not finding out about it other than after the case is adjudicated and then their name goes on a list, and that's all we know. And recently here in Marion County, the Statesman Journal filed a public records request, and the local district attorney made the school district turn over some of the records. but not any of the, there was no visual or audio. So I'm trying to draft some legislation right now where we can get access to some of those records, and I'm afraid with this I'm going to defeat my purpose. So I'm just have some concerns. But this, is this just about the audio and any visual and any photographs? Is that all you want the protective order on?
Could I respond, Chair Burke?
Please do.
Senator Walker, it's very explicit in terms of, you know, we're talking about sexually explicit photographs, videotapes of or audio tapes of children expressing about what happened to them and so forth. Police reports themselves don't seem to be covered by this. So I think, and of course, as far as the suspect is concerned, if you're trying to find out what a suspect did, the government is not prohibited in the bottom part of the statute from doing its job. And for example, the DA's office or police department could share its information with any government agency so that they could do their job.
Mm-hmm.
What we couldn't do is, you know, if somebody was just curious or wanted a bunch of lewd photographs,
right,
we wouldn't have to give them to them. So that's the good part of it. And it would spare the victim. And I would suspect, you know, what we try to do, if you're only trying to find out information to do your work as a government official, we would probably want to block out the name of the victim, so there would be,
mm-hmm,
you get all the information, but you wouldn't have anything that was needlessly embarrassing to the victim.
Madam Chair, there can be some redacting going on, so, and I don't have a problem with that. I'm going to cogitate on this for a little bit. You've got some amendments you're working on. I want to protect the victim's privacy tremendously in the way that you're trying to, but I also want to make sure that we're not going to bury the information that we need to have. Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, while you're looking at this, if I can direct your attention when you think about it further, in the printed bill, sticking with what you have before you, starting on line 26, are the purposes you still get to access the information, and you may, given your scenario you just gave us, want to turn to page 2, lines 4 and 5, to see whether or not you think in your legislative duties you would fall within some of that proposed language.
Okay. I think what Senator Walker is getting at, and I would certainly concur, is we want to make sure that we provide no protection to any perpetrators in the course of trying to protect the victims. And I know it's a fine, it's a tricky deal to do one and not the other, but I hope you'll continue working on that. Are there other questions? Thank you very much. Next we will take Kelly Scott.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I signed up as neutral on this bill because in discussing this with members of our organization, we do not have a problem complying with court's protective orders. We already do so on a number of issues, and so that is certainly not a problem. And we often find ourselves in a difficult position when our clients, who have a right to an entire copy of their file, request so and want us to send things to them. So this would prohibit us from doing that, and we have no problem following the court order. I have two concerns. One, I discussed with the Department of Justice prior to the hearing, and that is the term expert witness as it appears in the bill. I'm looking at the amendment, but I'll look at the bill itself. And that's on page 2 on line 1. It allows us to have the evidence examined by an expert witness for the court, the state, or any party. Frequently in many of these kind of cases, an attorney will hire an expert to consult, not necessarily to be a witness, but sometimes just educate us about the process, or sometimes as a potential witness, but they tell us, you know, they evaluate the state's evidence and they say, look, the state's right. And they can prove this, and we say, okay, thank you, you're not going to be a witness, and we don't call them. So we just want to make sure that because it says expert witness, that we're not going to be limited to somebody who appears on a witness list somewhere, because sometimes we confidentially hire
experts to consult with us on these matters. The Department of Justice has said that they're willing to work with us on that. The only other thing that just in sitting and listening to the testimony earlier that I'm now wondering about is a very small part of the statute, and that is the word disseminating is in there, and then later on in the statute it includes among the list of things that were not to copy or to disseminate any information of the prior sexual history of the victim. And I guess there are all kinds of forms that any information could take. And that may be oral information that's provided to our investigator from another witness that we talk to, and then if our investigator repeats that to me, I am ethically bound to tell my client what is learned in the investigation about the case. I may also be advising that client that it's not admissible under the rape shield law, but I think that I just would be concerned that we not be prohibited from giving our client any of the information that we're ethically bound to give them. So that's just another thing that I would talk to the Department of Justice about. But as I said, we're neutral on this bill, and we don't have a problem complying with court protective orders.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments, and I presume that it can be drafted in a way that will not put you in an ethical bind. Other questions? Thank you. Next, we have Stephanie Tuttle from the Oregon District Attorney's Association.
I am with the Oregon District Attorney's Association. My name is Stephanie Tuttle. I'm actually a prosecutor here in Marion County. I've been a child abuse prosecutor for over 7 years now and a general prosecutor for 12. And I'm here today to speak in behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association in support of this bill. We've talked a lot about the audio and the criminal history, the reporting history or the sexual history. What we haven't talked a whole lot about is images. So I'm going to direct most of my comments to images of children, specifically in sexually explicit and even in non-sexually explicit photos. In my county, if I am prosecuting a child case or any case and I have evidence that includes images of children in any state of nudity, whether it be sexually explicit or not, I do not turn those over and make copies for the defense. I believe that that is re-victimizing the victims in those pictures by copying them and having them out there. Every single copy that's out there is the potential for more harm. It's potential for more eyes to see it. And frankly, it's just not right. What I do is I will have a defense counsel come to my office and review the photographs there. That complies with the discovery statute. If it's needed to be copied for purposes of, say, expert viewing it to make sure it is in fact pornography, it is in fact a child, they are real images and so forth, then I will request from the court to get a protective order. But the protective order that I seek is actually even more restrictive than this, in that it allows me to copy it for the counsel for purposes of, you know, whatever they need it for, but it also requires them to return it back to me at the end of the case. This law doesn't require that, but by having it enacted in statute, at least it gives the court the guidance that this is the appropriate direction to take. I don't have a problem in my county getting these protective orders, but as you've heard from Mr. Forget, other counties do have these problems, and so this statute I think would give the court some good guidance in the correct direction here.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you for coming. Yes. Okay, I'll try this again. Terry Cantados.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Terry Quinteros, and I am the Program Director for Crime Survivors for Community Safety. And again, CSCS would like to strongly support Senate Bill 199. The victimization that is brought on by a sexual assault probably puts someone at the most vulnerable point in their life. And we believe that this is a very powerful piece of support that the victim can receive, knowing that any recorded evidence will not become a part of public record, and that this bill, therefore, helps to create a more victim-friendly atmosphere as well as adding to the reduction of future crime.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, well, this bill still needs a little work, so we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 199 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 200. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 200 also speaks to the statute of limitations in sex offenses, as we discussed earlier in Senate Bill 203. This bill would modify that statute to allow prosecution for enumerated sex offenses at any time after the commission of the offense in cases where physical evidence containing the DNA of the perpetrator is collected and preserved and is capable of being tested for its characteristics. There is a provision in the current law which states that where DNA evidence is collected, the prosecution may be commenced within 12 years after the commission of the offense. It only applies to rape in the first or second degree or sodomy in the first or second degree. This would change the current law to allow a longer list of offenses and allow the prosecution to be commenced at any time.
Thank you. We will start with the intrepid trio, Phyllis Barkers, Ronell Schenkel, and Paul Baguette. Thank you for coming back. You're wearing a spot in the carpet here.
We'll change seats to keep you entertained.
Oh, well, that's very confusing. Go ahead.
No handout. For the record, Ronell Schenkel, Policy Project and Legislative Coordinator for the Attorney General. I am here on behalf of Hardy Myers to offer his apologies that he could not be here. For the record, he is in Ways and Means, and his support of this bill being brought to you by the Sexual Assault Task Force. We have no amendments pending on this particular bill, so I will leave it to Phyllis and Paul to speak to you about the issue. I will mention, however, that in the hearing room before the hearing, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association did bring a brief item to my attention, but I haven't had time to talk with the rest of the group about that matter.
Thank you.
Again, Phyllis Barkhurst from the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, and thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Just want to briefly let you know where this bill came from. This was at the request of members of the Criminal Justice Committee of the task force, prosecutors and law enforcement from around the state.
Chair Burdick, ladies and gentlemen, with new technology now, DNA is an absolutely wonderful thing.
I have to tell yourself again.
I'm sorry, I'm Paul Burgett again, Pierce County DA and member of the Sexual Assault Task Force. DNA is doing wonderful things for us. The legislature passed a law where all convicted felons have to give a DNA sample, and which is wonderful, and we're getting cold hits. We solved in a rape case just recently that we would have had no chance of solving, and we're able to convict the perpetrator. So this is an absolutely wonderful thing. And statute of limitations are a very complicated thing. They have their purpose, and that is, it's called a statute of repose, so that, you know, if a case is really old, it's okay to eventually just forget about it. If the state can't get its act together, then let's move on. But in these cases, we're dealing with very urgent, traumatic crimes that are committed against women. So we have a vehicle now that if we ever run into a suspect's DNA, what we'll have is the DNA of a suspect at a crime scene. And that's something that will last virtually forever. They're getting DNA out of mummies now. And if this person ever gets convicted of a felon or we develop them as a suspect, we've got, we know pretty much who did it. And the statistics we're getting now are, you know, it would be like the one person in 10 billion would have a given DNA. It's absolutely mind-boggling. We're light years beyond where we were just a few years ago. So we believe that the law follow the technology here, and that we should extend the statute of limitations, be able to prosecute somebody at any time if we're ever able to develop them as a suspect. That's pretty much what we have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Senator Pruszynski.
The list that's here, could someone go over why we came up with the list that's here? I mean, I'm just looking at the different charges. They range from a Class A misdemeanor on up into the felony ranks.
I'll just say, Chair Burdick, Senator Pruszynski, we could come up with scenarios
as far out as they may be or far-fetched for all of these. That's why we listed them, even though some would be obviously more common, such as the rape and sodomy 1 and 2 and sexual abuse 1 and 2 and the incest statute. But we could come up with circumstances in which we felt, even though it might be rare, but it might occur for the others. So it just reflects those conversations.
All right. Another question, if I could. In the work of the task force, did y'all look at other states? My concern, as you've heard through this panel regarding extension of statute of limitations, one of them is for a Class A misdemeanor, not to be, take away from the seriousness of that offense, but what I'm hearing is that someone that may have been involved or accused of being involved in a Class A misdemeanor could be brought to trial 50, 60 years later, as compared to what, I mean, we used to have as more defined levels of a break in time of for statute of limitations. And I guess in conjunction with that, what, if any, obligations the state would have in this case, since most of these would be going through the district attorney's offices, or I guess some could actually go through municipal court as well, since by Class A misdemeanor, to actually act upon whatever they have in a timely manner instead of just letting it sit there for who knows for what reasons, for how long.
May I respond, Chair Burdick and Senator Brzezinski? As a practical matter, DAs are still going to be picking and choosing what they feel it's appropriate to pursue, and there's always the speedy trial provision of the Constitution that especially with lower level charges, I think it would be very unlikely that DAs would pursue those after an extended period of time. They would have the option of doing so, but you could run into speedy trial problems, and the DA would have to weigh all sorts of things, whether it's appropriate to prosecute, whether the person has been in any other trouble. One thing we find with sex offenders, probably more than almost any other type of offenders, that they stay in business for a long time, and they don't change their behavior. Sometimes we only catch them periodically, but if it can be useful to have a case to pursue. And as you remember, I think Jimmy Hoffa, they had to get him on tax charges, even though they thought he did everything else. And well, we just kind of have to look at the broad range of options and whether they're appropriate. But you're exactly right. Those would be much less likely to be pursued.
Well, the speedy trial really only applies after a charge has been filed, isn't that correct? I mean, speedy trial would have no bearing on the statute of limitations.
Well, I think there's an argument, Chair Burdick, in that regard, but I think there's a point where if this government, I think there'd be a due process issue if the government doesn't take any action at all, because even if we have DNA, there can still be consent issues that could be raised. I mean, just because you have DNA doesn't mean we can convict somebody of rape. And if the person's witness that there was consent involved has died from old age, and I think we'd have a due process problem at that point, and we'd have to evaluate that and think, you know, is this really something we can and should do?
Certainly. Okay, thank you. Are there other... Senator Byer?
Just a question, not for these witnesses, I guess, but clarification. I wasn't aware that some of these were misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. So if someone could provide us a list of what on that list, would be helpful for those of us who aren't.
The only one I saw right off was sex abuse in the third degree.
Okay.
I haven't looked at the others to see, but the others are pretty much felonies.
Yeah. Council may have some insight on that.
Senator Brzezinski is correct. Sex abuse in the third degree, I believe, is the only misdemeanor.
Yeah, I mean, that's one that we actually handle through my municipal court. We have all misdemeanor authority.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Walker, do you have a question?
You know, Madam Chair, I don't know why I have questions about these bills today, but I do. This one, I remember working on this in the 2001 session. We extended the statute of limitations on rape cases in 2001 from whatever it was to the 12-year period, and I did quite a bit of research and convinced the committee that 12 years was a good time limit to settle on, I think the discussion was to take it to like 25 or something like that at the time, and we settled on 12. And now this bill wants to remove all statute of limitation time period. Is that correct? Just, you know, as Senator Pozanski said, 50
where
years
DNA
later.
Where the DNA is present. Yeah.
Where the DNA is present.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker. That is correct. The two things have changed since the 2001 session, I think, reflecting from what District Attorney Burgett said, is one, the CODIS, the database, has really made a difference in the options of being able to run cold cases and see if there's matches. So it gives options that weren't there before, and the ability to run DNA when the costs have gone down and there's more federal government support to states to run these cases where there are no suspect cases have given us both the technology, the database, and the funding that weren't in place in 2001. So we feel like this reflects more accurately the options at the times than what was going on in 2001.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. I think what we'll do now is take the other proponent of this bill, and then we have a couple of opponents who will be coming up. So we'll right now take Stephanie Tuttle from the DA Association.
Good afternoon again, Stephanie Tuttle, Oregon District Attorneys Association, and again, I'm here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 200. Essentially, what this does is give us more opportunity to bring perpetrators to justice. I'll give you an example. Woman is jogging in a park. Man leaps out behind her, pins her down, rapes her forcibly. She doesn't see him. She never even gets a look at him. He knocks her out. The only identifying information that we have is the semen in her vagina when she's at the hospital being examined. That's it. We've got his DNA and nothing else, and literally nothing else to go on. What this bill will do is enable us, if he gets caught doing something else and his DNA gets taken 15 years later, this allows that victim to have justice in our system. It doesn't put a time limit on his bad conduct. It lets us bring him to justice, and that's why we're in support of this.
But under existing law, you'd have 12 years to bring him to
justice. Chairman Burdick, you're absolutely right. We would have 12 years, and this just lets it go farther.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now for the other side of the story, we will hear from Kelly Skye and Andrea Meyer. You can come up together if you wish.
Good afternoon again. Kelly Skye, appearing, a legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And Chair Burdick and members of the committee of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association opposes this bill. The first and primary reason that we oppose this bill is just on a policy level, we oppose the expansion of the statute of limitations, especially when it is to remove all statute of limitations. And I think that Senator Ringo and Senator Pozanski touched on the main concerns there, and that is that the innocent people are accused of sex crimes in the state of Oregon, and the longer we wait between the time of the offense and the time that a person defends themselves, the harder it is to prove innocence. And you all know evidence becomes stale, witnesses' memories fade, witnesses disappear. There are all kinds of reasons why it's difficult to defend yourself the more time that passes. So the statute of limitations is there to protect the innocent, and it also serves as a reminder to the state that they need to prioritize and move cases through so that they have some motivation to process cases. And as I think it was Senator Pozanski alluded earlier, if there's no statute of limitations, there's no reason for the prosecutor to sort of keep putting that file aside on their desk because they know, well, that one's going to be around forever and I can work on that later. That said, I have a couple of specific problems with the way that the bill reads if the committee were to try to move this forward in any form at all. I think that the language needs to be changed, and this is what I had discussed with the Department of Justice. For one, if you look at the language that was amended in, as Senator Walker said, in the 2001 session, it required, it actually says, if the defendant is identified after the period described in the subsection on the basis of DNA, that requires that DNA be the link that revives this case, or that revives it from the statute of limitations. The way it's drafted now, it says only that if physical evidence contained DNA of the perpetrator of the crime is collected and preserved. It doesn't require that that evidence be what is reviving it. It doesn't require that that evidence even be used in the prosecution of the case. So they collect DNA evidence, and then 15 years later they decide we want to prosecute so-and-so, and we collected that evidence, and that's all that this statute requires. So I would like to see, if this were to go forward, I think that the language, the way it was drafted before, was much tighter and restrictive. I also had the concerns that Senator Brzezinski had, in that there's a great expansion of the number of crimes that are covered here, and many of them are consensual crimes, and as was mentioned, sex abuse in the third degree is a Class A misdemeanor, involves touching, which would not have DNA evidence. So the crimes that were first deemed to be appropriate under this expansion were rape in the first and second degree and sodomy in the first and second degree, and those seem to be more appropriate than some of these other offenses like sex abuse in the third degree and rape in the third degree, which is actually a consensual sex with someone who's under 16 and as you're probably aware, can be the 15-year-old who has a relationship with a 21-year-old. All of that said, I did want to mention that the state is coming in here and suggesting that DNA is this miracle evidence and that it can be used to prosecute people and should be available indefinitely to prosecute people. And OCDLA and ACLU in the past have proposed legislation through the Innocence Project, which deals with DNA testing and makes it available to convicted people who are in prison or out of prison to be tested and see if they can be exonerated. And I'm sure that most members of the committee are well aware that many people have been exonerated through DNA evidence across the country. The state fought hard against that and placed limitations, time limitations on when those tests could be performed, and they have to be done through post-conviction relief, which has timelines, and are not allowed for someone who actually pled guilty. So we would ask that that you reconsider some of those reforms, and we'd like to talk about some of those reforms, because if DNA is going to be considered trustworthy indefinitely, then it ought to be considered trustworthy to clear innocent people who are convicted of crimes wrongly.
And it's true that if you have a case involving DNA right now, I imagine you find it that yourself arguing from time to time that the DNA got there through some other method than the commission of the crime.
That could be. Many times, you know, depending on where it was collected from and how it was collected, that could be an issue. And you know, again, that becomes an issue when we don't have statutory standards for the collection and retention of DNA evidence. And so 20 years down the road, we don't know how that evidence would have been handled. We don't know if we're going to be able, if that person in trying to defend themselves is going to be able to tell such things as what you're alluding to.
Because DNA, in fact, can be from something as simple as a hair. Is that correct?
Correct. And Chair Burdick, I will confess not to be a DNA expert, and didn't have time to get someone from our organization who practices and is more of an expert in that area. But you're correct. DNA can be gathered from a number of sources, and especially under some of these consensual offenses that are included in this bill, there would be reason to find someone's DNA. You know, if it were a consensual relationship. So I think that the mere presence of DNA doesn't necessarily solve a lot of the problems that the statute of limitations is designed to solve.
And when you go into court, have you ever had a circumstance where DNA evidence was conclusive and no other evidence was considered?
No, I haven't. Chair Burdick, I think that would be I haven't had one of those cases, and I think that the only time that that kind of case would come up would possibly be one of these cold hits that that the state has referred to here today, but I have not had one of those cases.
But I mean, in a case where a case is fresh and there's DNA, has there ever been a case that you've been involved with or that you know of where the DNA is submitted, case closed, no other evidence, no other testimony?
No. Chair Burdick, the state oftentimes does a very excellent job of investigating a case and frequently gets statements from the offender and all kinds of other witness interviews and other forensic evidence is collected and tested. So I do think that DNA alone would be a risk.
Your argument is that as time goes on, those other investigation options would not be there to the extent.
Correct. And especially when we're talking about cases involving younger folks, people age and become more mature and memories solidify, whether in the exact form that they occurred or not. But over time, things change, as you know. Evidence becomes stale. People, without having the knowledge that a criminal case was going to arise out of something, witnesses are not likely to remember details that they may have. They're not likely to remember relationships and people's character for trustworthiness. And there are all kinds of... And the forensic evidence, quite frankly, it is not always preserved in a manner that is accessible and usable 20 years after the fact.
Thank you. Thank you for putting that on the record. Are there questions before we move on? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. We do oppose Senate Bill 200, and I've passed out for you a paper done by our national on legislation similar on the federal level, and I'm just going to highlight some things. The statute of limitations is primarily designed to assure fairness in our justice system. An ability to prepare a defense is clearly undermined in a case where a claim is revived after a period of time such that evidence is lost, memories have faded, and witnesses have disappeared. A tolling of the statute of limitations might be considered for DNA in cases in the event that DNA evidence was both permanent and incontrovertible. But as the memo describes in more detail, neither of these conditions are met by DNA testing. The notion that DNA evidence is permanent and incontrovertible is wrong in both principle and practice. In 2003, the Houston Crime Lab was shut down after an independent audit revealed widespread problems associated with the handling and analysis of DNA evidence. While the problems uncovered in these labs are thought to be the exception rather than the rule, these cases should remind us of the fallibility and limitations inherent in DNA testing and the need for careful scrutiny, particularly in cases that hinge on DNA evidence alone, which is the focus of this bill. The techniques for preserving DNA samples have improved over the years. But DNA, despite some testimony earlier today, I believe, and from our research, cannot be maintained indefinitely. The actual rate at which a DNA sample degrades varies depending on the cell type, the amount of DNA present, and the conditions under which it is preserved. So even under optimal conditions, DNA will continuously degrade over time. In Houston, many of the 49 cases that have been retested so far have now produced inconclusive results. None of these cases involve DNA evidence that is older than 8 years, yet degradation has occurred. DNA testing is often construed in both the media and the courtroom as infallible. This is wrong, again, in both principle and practice. Any scientific procedure that involves human execution and judgment has some probability of error, and I want to describe a few types: sampling and handling errors. In 2002, it was discovered that 26-year-old Lazaro Sudolusin was mistakenly charged with multiple felonies because the Las Vegas Police Crime Lab switched the labels on two DNA samples. Inadvertent transfer of DNA, Senator Burdick, may be something you raised earlier. Samples can be contaminated by the inadvertent transfer of trace amounts of DNA. Ironically, this error type is of increasing concern as DNAs become increasingly sensitive. Analysis errors.
Many people think that DNA testing is objective, but in fact, interpretation of the results can be highly subjective. When DNA is typed, a computer-generated graph displays a series of peaks corresponding short repeating segments of DNA. Everyone has these segments, but they vary in length. The computer labels them are based on their length. An ambiguity can arise in interpreting these graphs, especially in cases where there is a mixture of two or more sources of DNA. Misinterpreting DNA tests does lead to false convictions, and you all are aware of what's gone on across the country in that. Timothy Durham of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was convicted of raping an 11-year-old girl and was sentenced to 3,000 years in prison despite having produced 11 alibi witnesses who placed him in another state at the time of the crime. The prosecution's case rested almost entirely on DNA tests, which showed that Durham's genotype matched that of the semen donor. He had post-conviction DNA testing that showed that he should have been excluded, as a possible suspect, and reanalysis of the initial test showed that a misinterpretation arose from the difficulty of separating mixed samples. The lab had failed to separate completely the male and female DNA from the semen stain, and the combination of DNA segments from the two sources produced a genotype that could have included him. He was released in prison in 1997 after serving 4 years. Reporting errors. Another inmate served nearly 5 years in jail for a rape he could not have committed. His conviction rested entirely on the basis of DNA testing performed in Houston Police Crime Lab. Reanalysis of the lab report showed that the lab technician had mistakenly reported his DNA profile was included in the profile of semen taken from the back of the car where the rape was committed, when it was not. In addition, she presented the DNA data to the jury in a misleading way that overstated its value, and state failed to provide statistical estimates that would have demonstrated his profile was one of the many that could have been included in the sample. The potential error, even if it's small, can be very significant in cases where there is little or no evidence against the suspect. Tolling the statute of limitations indefinitely for cases involving DNA evidence would only exacerbate the current error rate associated with cold hit cases. It is highly unlikely that a case brought against a defendant many years past the date of the crime would rest on anything other than a cold hit match against a DNA database. Alternative explanations for the match may be nearly impossible for the defendant to argue. Errors that may have occurred in sample collection and analysis earlier might be impossible to uncover, when the lab analysis and law enforcers involved in the segment of that process are no longer around. A crucial witness who might have been able to confirm an innocent explanation for inadvertent DNA transfer may no longer be found. Retesting of the biological sample may not be possible if the sample was not preserved or in cases where it is completely degraded. But even where it's been retained, partial degradation may render results of retesting ambiguous and particularly susceptible to error. Tolling the statute of limitations indefinitely, even in a narrow range of cases, establishes a dangerous precedent that implies that DNA evidence is both permanent and incontrovertible. Defendants in those cases would have been stripped of their ability to raise fair questions about the value and admissibility of DNA evidence, and any wrongful convictions would be almost impossible to uncover. Now, I think I just want to conclude by what I think a lot of us think of about fingerprints and it being a science that we can rely on to establish someone's innocence or guilt. Brandon Mayfield, unfortunately in Oregon, is a prime example of how our technology can and does lead to innocent people being swept up into the criminal justice system. Thank you.
Thank you. I've been on judiciary since 1999, and this is the first time I've ever heard of a 3,000-year sentence.
I was shocked. I guess I'm pleased it wasn't in Oregon, but it certainly it does happen.
Yes, thank you. Are there questions or comments from the committee?
Chair, I don't think the planet's going to be here 3,000 years from now. That was an interesting sentence.
At the rate I'm going, I'm certainly not going to last that long.
Senator Burdick, Senator Walker, I think what it shows is that they thought this person was so evil that he was clear that he was innocent. And unfortunately, in that case, he was innocent.
Yes.
Makes it harder for him to prove his innocence.
Thank you for that information. Appreciate it. At this point, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 200, and unless there's other business, by members, we will adjourn the committee.
And Madam Chair, I hope you notice that we have a...